If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday. You know what that means? It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm Kara. I'll be your host this evening. And we have with us this evening as well, returning co-host Rob Palmer. Rob, how are you doing?
Just great. I survived the tsunami on the east coast of the United States. Oh, no, it wasn't a real tsunami. It's just my stupid phone app blasted like there was a tsunami. Get to high ground. Turns out It was an error in the whole system. It was a test message sent out, and many phone apps decided to think it was real and to tell the people to evacuate. Nice. So I survived that.
I'm glad you did. Did you actually evacuate?
No, I thought it was a little ridiculous. I said, if there's a tsunami coming that can hit me on, an hour and a half drive from the shore in New Jersey, it's a world-ending event, and it doesn't make any sense for me to get to higher ground.
That's fair. That's fair.
Did you see the movie Deep Impact?
Yes.
It wipes out Washington, you know, so that would have been the case.
So he said it's a spiritual tsunami.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, I'm glad you survived.
How are you doing? So you're far enough from the hurricane, right? That didn't get inland.
I am far enough from the hurricane. I am now, this week, I am joining you from the lovely state of Vermont.
Oh, so, you're on the East Coast. Oh, wow.
Yes. I am apparently near the tsunami.
Yeah, you could have been wiped out.
I could have been. I didn't even know about it. That would have been ironic. But no, I survived that. It is quite lovely here, although it does rain an awful lot. But that is my observation of Vermont thus far. That's all I have to report. I didn't do much else this week, so... Okay, so without any further ado, I am going to introduce our speaker, who needs no introduction, but it is in the outline, so we're going to do it anyway. David Teachout is a mental health therapist and photographer focused on and teaching how creativity intersects with mental flexibility. David grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, attending a Bible college and receiving a bachelor's degree in theology and psychology. During his studies there, David deconverted and has been on a journey of appreciating humanity and all the stories we create to build meaning and purpose. He has a master's in both forensic psychology and counseling psychology and is currently at work on a doctorate in clinical psychology. He's a big nerd and we love that here. David has been actively working within the field of psychology as a therapist, social worker, advocate, and subject matter expert for over 15 years, 15 to 20. In his spare time, David enjoys reading a copious amount, both fiction and nonfiction, exploring perspective through photography, and maintains a blog at lifeweavings.com and a podcast at humanitiesvalues.com. And I am really looking forward to him adding to my Goodreads reading list this week. Okay, David, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Let me go ahead and turn my mute
off. It amazes me, David, that at one point I was very close to catching up to you in your appearances, but I'm at four or something.
Yeah, Rob, you're slacking. We're gonna have to get you back on here again.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's gonna be a little tricky.
No hope.
Last year, I think I did 11. So It really, I think Kara and I started having fun because they're like, we need to do one a month, and let's just do this. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It got silly.
Yeah. But quite able to maintain that. But
yeah, but we do our best.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we're excited to have you back.
Anyway. Thank you. As always, happy to be here. And yes, I will be able to hang out for the hangout afterwards for about an hour or so. So by all means, if there are questions, we don't get to them, hang out and we will. As well, feel free at any time in the future to reach out. I'm a big one on giving resources. It's why I've set up my own website the way I did. Because just got tons on there. But as well, happy to, answer quick questions, anything related to psych and religion and so on. I can talk about this stuff all day long, which is good because I have student debt to prove that I can talk about it all day long.
So this is why you get the big atheist bucks coming here to these talks.
Yeah, the big ones. Yeah.
It's worth it.
That's why I'm going through the very big annoyance of finally getting back into my doctorate program. But yeah,
we need to talk more about that offline or in the
hangout. Yeah. Last year was tough. So we're getting back into it. It's going to be good.
Burnout is a thing. Mental health is important in grad school.
Yes, it is.
We need to talk on
that. But, you know, so today, you know, I know, you know, Dr. Reid, you know, Daryl definitely, you know, gave a, you know, presentation, I think a month ago, give or take, on, you know, religious trauma. I will not be going over that again because it's been done. So by all means, as soon as that comes out, you know, on YouTube and whatnot, you can take a look at it. You know, some of what I might say, you know, might be a little different, but that's why we're here, because we love exploring these things. And as well, one thing with the poll questions, which I will get to, is that if you do look for that show, Happy, be prepared for really, really often disturbing violence. Just as a FYI, if that's not your thing, do not turn it on. You have been warned. But But if you like Law and Order, the guy, the dark haired guy, I'm trying to remember his name.
Who, is it SVU or regular?
Yes, SVU.
Stabler.
Stabler, yeah, the guy who played him. He's the main person. So, in a very, very different role. It's so wrong. Yeah.
So I feel like this show should be called Disturbing rather than Happy.
A little bit. A little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So just, you know, FYI.
Do you want us to go over the poll questions now? Would you like
I'll actually touch on them a little bit here as we get through. So, but that is a good point from the chat that what is it? I forget the numbers now because I'm sure they've changed, but I know like 10, 15 years ago or something like that, like the number of Chris Maloney. Yes. Thank you. Is the actor like the number like kids by the age of 10 have seen like 10,000 murders or something like that on television. I mean, it's just in an astronomical number. Somebody can look it up. It's out there. I don't know if they've maintained the research on what that might mean. So, and of course it's an average. So, but yeah.
It's a lot. And yet we censor other kinds of content, like anything remotely sexy is, you know, immediately cut out, but you know, murders, violence, fine.
Are we counting stuff like in like the Roadrunner, you know, and like, you know,
I'm not even sure. It's been a while.
I
don't know. I mean, it's been a while since I read that research and exactly what it's saying. So take the numbers with a large brick of salt at this point. I mean, Bugs Bunny murdered. In fact, what was it? I saw read an article speaking of weird things. Was it Queen for some concert is not going to be playing Fat Bottom Girls because it was deemed too offensive for a younger audience. They are going to keep now I'm forgetting blanking on, but basically it's about an assassination. Like, really, that's okay. But
oh boy.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
The world is funny. Yeah. I mean, I grew up, you know, speaking of, you know, getting closer now to the topic, but you know, I grew up very fundamentalist Christian and Protestant, and you know, one of the things was that we literally were okay with watching some of the most violent things out there, but literally, like, but if a boob showed up on the screen and like it had to be fast forwarded and cut out,
right. Wasn't like the Passion of the Christ one of the most violent movies that was like ever?
I mean, I affectionately referred to it as a snuff film,
busloads of evangelicals going to see that movie,
it's ridiculous. I actually had a journalism teacher who at the time I didn't agree with his politics. Now I'd love to go back and say hi to him. But who at the time when we watched, what was it? We ended up watching Romeo and Juliet during a break, and the sex scene in it, because it showed her breasts, he dubbed over it with Larry Moe and Curly beating the crap out of one another. And his whole point was somehow this is okay.
But oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, as a dyed in the wool conservative, religious person at the time, I was like, oh, come on. But it dug at me. I love to say, like, I look back on it, it was a bit of a, yeah, thought twister. So
interesting.
Who knows? But with all of this, you know, part of the issue here with discussing religion in general, is that we crave explanation. I mean, we're literally coming up with stories all the damn time. And it's really what, in many ways, consciousness is. You know, there's actually an interesting theory called the blind brain theory out there, which I highly recommend people reading. I'm not sure if I agree with it fully, but it's interesting. And a few others have had variations on it. But it's basically the idea that consciousness exists precisely because we don't have access to the neurological, lives that we are always living, i.e. pre-conscious or unconsciously. And that because of that lack of biological access to it, the result ends up being, because that's more efficient, the result ends up being this conscious experience that has almost very little to do with it. It's kind of an afterthought, pardon the pun, it exists purely as a fiction so that we never, in order to hide the fact that we really have no idea what the hell's going on, in our brains. But it's an interesting, yeah, there's a paper out there. It's free. By all means, you can find it. It's pretty good. And making it more fun, the author of the paper is a fantastic fantasy writer. So, yeah. But with that, so part of this here is that, for that matter, why the hell are we continuing to talk about religion at RFR? Why is this such a big deal? Why does even RFR exist? What's the point behind all of this? Well, the point is that religion isn't going away anytime soon. You know, it's one of the things I love about, Frank Herbert is, in his Dune series, is literally you go like 10,000 years into the future and Jews still exist. I mean, it's just like you'd think after a while they give up on waiting for the Messiah, but nope, 10,000 years, it's not played for laughs at all. Like it's a fascinating exploration of just what it means for people to perpetually need and manifest stories in order to give structure, in order to find meaning and purpose. And that's why we're here, is that these things in various forms have touched on us in varying degrees of, frankly, awfulness. And so we're here to figure out, well, what can I take from it, if anything? And there's a debate. And it's a debate that I've waffled on a little bit over time and probably will continue. What is the nature of all of this? Why are we even doing it at all here on creating this? And there are various, quote unquote answers for that as well. But part of this is that fundamentally we live from a psychological perspective in as if constructions. So within acceptance commitment therapy, or ACT, which is the therapeutic model that I largely operate under, highly recommend reading any of the books out there on it. But I think, in fact, one of the resources that I put in lists is Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, so by Stephen Hayes, which as a beginning workbook on literally living more healthily emotionally, it's one of my top three hands down recommendations. But we live in these as if constructions. We live in this kind of conceptualized self navigating the story, in a sense from the movie, Matrix, you know, when Neo eventually comes initially back into the Matrix and Morpheus is there going, well, you know, this image that you have of yourself is this, you know, digital representation of yourself that you possess internally. Now, there's a lot of problems actually with how that works, but as a kind of analogy or metaphor for that conceptualized self, it's great because that is what we're doing all the time, is we have a image of ourselves singular at any given moment. But that's the trap.
David, did you yeah. know that in the original script of The Matrix, one of the characters was transgender, and in The Matrix, they were going to be the opposite sex?
That would be interesting.
Yeah. It was the character, and they kept the name Switch. Yeah. Was the character.
Oh, okay. Yeah. This was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was one of the few that actually loved the fourth one. And where
you better, know, the Wachowski better than sisters, the other sequels. I agree.
Certainly different. Yeah. It was definitely just the exploration of the ideas. I can talk about
but I thought that was fascinating. It's the idea you were talking about, where your self-image is what's expressed in The Matrix. And that character, I don't remember which the gender was, but thought, you know, that they were the opposite gender. So in The Matrix, they were the opposite gender. And as it's unfortunate that they took that out. And if people don't know, both the writers, producers, creators of The Matrix, both then came out as trans.
Yes.
It was after that event, right? If you look at this, the credits on the movie, it says the brothers, you know, and then
in the original one, first one, yeah,
that is correct. And one after the other, they transitioned to women.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, it's a, what's fascinating about it is, and like, and this is where another issue of our craving for explanation is that when Matrix first came out, I was still a believer. I was actually going to a Bible college. And I remember at the time, like, it was constantly being used in sermons as a Christian allegory. Like, just it was incredible, like, how often this was being used in that way, even though clearly, especially in retrospect, so not even close to what they were, you know, wanting to touch on.
Well, the Wachowski brothers certainly put stuff in there, like, you know, Trinity and Neo, and he dies and gets resurrected. And
they very much like to delve into various, mythologies and touching on, you know, many of the kind of themes from that, which is why it's still really damn good these days and why we can still talk about it forever. And of course,
we're going to add that to our hangout list.
It really needs. Yeah, this needs to be like a community online thing.
I wrote an article. Are we really living in the Matrix? Should I put that in the chat? Anybody's interested?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It covers that whole idea of we in a simulation?
In fact, there are two books, The Philosophy of the Matrix and a sequel to it as well, which uses the Matrix to explore various, you know, issues around ontology, epistemology, and so on. Really a lot of fun, actually. It's just actual philosophers utilizing pop culture as part of an entire series. There's like Westworld and philosophy, Batman and philosophy, The Expanse and philosophy. There's just all sorts of stuff. It's really fun. Ooh, good question. I will get to that at the end. and so, you know, so all of this is like, we're trying to figure out what, not just what the meaning is. And I think that question often causes a problem because it assumes that we're searching for meaning rather than actively creating it in the process of that search itself. Like, we come into this world without a blank slate. That has been well established. And so we have biological proclivities. We have, that include personality structures, how we respond to, various states of distress, you know, in the sense of, our thresholds for generic physiological arousal, you know, our thresholds for dealing with, you know, stress or stressors is, you know, set by and large by, you know, by genetics. And in combination then, of course, with our, you know, social experiences, but by and large, you're not going to move it too much. So when you find yourself, say, gravitating on the spectrum of, you know, extroversion, introversion, you know, don't beat yourself up about, oh my God, I wish I was more of this or more of that. No, we have a baseline and then we have space of movement. And in fact, the movement in some ways, rather than the baseline, is in some ways, at least to me, almost more indicative of our humanity. Like if we just begin with our genetic biological baselines, we're fundamentally like, that doesn't really give us much in the way of difference. It doesn't make us unique in the sense of singular or, you know, part of our, you know, our species is not just our genes. Our species is our capacity for flexibility up and down across that baseline that each individual one of us is capable of being. That's why we go to therapy, for that matter. That's why we study philosophy. That's why we go to, you know, go to school and, you know, and hopefully get educated, which doesn't obviously only occur at school, if not in some cases. And so, you know, it's like, it's why, you know, one of the things that I keep bringing up and will at the end is the act of participation and exploration with varying ideas, even when, or especially when you don't like overtly or even at all agree with them, because by wrestling with these things, you allow, give yourself some greater degree of flexibility in going, okay, maybe there's something going on here that I have to reflect on a little bit more, because likelihood is, in fact, not just likely, it is inevitable that anything you hold, because again, it's as if we're kind of operating on guesswork, you know, that that we're going to be wrong to some degree, if only by ignorance. I mean, holy crap. You know, some of the times that I work with on clients, I'm learning in more than just a Hallmarky way. Like I'm literally learning factual things. Like I've learned about cybersecurity and, you know, various states of, you know, the military and, you know, the experiences that people are going through that I will never encounter. It's why fiction books are so popular, is there, they provide us the opportunity to express and get outside of ourselves, even though we really technically can never do that. But it gives us the, at least facsimile of doing so. And by that, we then allow ourselves that, you know, possibility of expanding, you know, how we're going to react to, well, trauma, stressors, things that are going to be happening, you know, with us. So this is why, incidentally, to get to the poll, the first, you know, question around the reptilian brain is that, one, we don't possess one. We just don't.
It was all a lie.
It was. Unfortunately, it's one of the most continually peddled BSs that, I mean, it's in most intro to psych books these days. It's really...
Yeah,
it's astonishing the fact that this thing still has legs. Har.
I see what you did there. Does it have a tail?
It does have a tail.
But if you pull the tail off, does the tail regrow? So can you explain what that is supposed to have meant, reptilian?
Yeah. So the idea here is that in looking at human evolution, that our brains developed in this kind of bottom up linear fashion, where we have a baseline of a reptilian brain of the like amygdala, hippocampus, you know, medulla, you know, and so on. And that as we, you know, human beings evolved into human beings, that we added on as a kind of like stackable, you know, areas of our brain ending in our, you know, prefrontal cortex. Now, One, yes, as noted in the chat, Triune Brain model. And I think it was McLean was the scientist who came up with it. But of course, two big things with it. One, all mammals, not just human beings, have frontal cortexes. So, and two, it fundamentally defies evolutionary theory. Evolution does not operate in a linear progression, adding things in a kind of stackable way. Like, that's not at all how it works. So even at the time it was offered, it was largely like, you've got to, no, this doesn't actually make any sense even then. But it makes an intuitive level of sense because we work and exist in our lives in a way that in this kind of like, you know, the fight between emotion and intellect, you know, the idea that, you know, you hear variations of it, like, I don't know what came over me. You know, I saw red, you know, and, you know, how we're supposed, you know, supposedly the healthy life is the, you know, kind of, you know, non-emotional data driven. Thank you, the allusion to Star Trek. But, you know, the, you know, kind of non-emotional way of just here, I'm going to analytically consider what's going on. In fact, it's still, you know, one of those things that is often used even in some atheist communities, around, you know, like religious believers are driven by this and I am, you know, driven by reason. And that's why, you know, it's like we join groups like I fucking love science and everything else because I am a reasonable person. And it's like, okay. Yeah. So
tell me you lack emotional intelligence without right, saying yes. You lack emotional intelligence.
Exactly. Right. Right. So, and all of that is, of course, bunk. You know, none of it works that way. And it's not at all helpful either because, you know, so from Will Storer, his The Status Game, which is, yeah, Kara's like, you keep recommending this one. Like, well, yeah, you do.
Still haven't read it, but I'm going to.
And so, but he notes how the brain feeds us distorted, simplistic, and self-serving tales about why they are above us and they are beneath, this whole notion of status in comparison with other people. In this way, complex truths become reduced to cartoonish moral struggles between good and evil. We're all vulnerable to believing such narratives. They form our experience of reality. They make us feel better about ourselves. They motivate us to strive to improve our rank. But they're delusional. They're responsible for much of the hubris, hatred, and hypocrisy that stalk our species. They can even drive us to kill. This whole othering is itself a fundamental drive that we exhibit quite often. Eric Fromm has a fascinating idea around aggression and how humans seem to have this in his mind, you know, a uniquely malignant form of it, that it in fact isn't quite true because there are other animals that seem to do commit violence seemingly for the sake of just violence. We're not the only ones. But we seem to do it clearly in the most imaginative of ways throughout history. And it's a bit of a, it's, you know, question.
I know some cetacean species, I don't know, you know, can't get into the mind what their motive is, mm-hmm. but they'll like take baby seals and they just throw them around to each other like they're playthings.
Yeah, that would be an example. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. There's
also cats. Yeah.
Yes.
That is true. And I have two cats, so I don't want to think of them that way, but thank you for putting that image in my mind. Yes.
No problem.
Yeah.
Team dog right here.
Team dog.
We actually did find a dead mouse that got into our house once with not a part taken off it or eaten or anything. And it was just like probably thrown around to death. Maybe it had a heart attack because my cats must have just played with it all night because like it was fun. Because they don't know that they're not outside cats. So they didn't never saw one before. They didn't know that was food. It didn't come in a can. They didn't know what it was.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not a cat guy. Yeah. My dog is currently hiding from the, it's down to 87. We topped out at like 95 today. So, yeah. But, you know, so part of then the stories that we're making is also labels as an example. And in some ways, you know, labels are essentially like a means of providing cover for our logical fallacies. I mean, even at their basic level, a label is a cover for a particular prescribed set of data points. So, which means that we're actively choosing some and removing others, and which frankly sounds a lot like confirmation bias. Again, this is not about getting rid of labels. Good luck anyway. We're not going to get rid of this, but it is a point at which being very careful about getting stuck on our stories and thinking of them as singular monolithic truths, which is, by the way, as we get into it, exactly what various forms of fundamentalism, religious and otherwise, political as well, want us to. Like, it's the notion that here's the story, I'm giving it to you. It is singular. You don't need to think outside of this. It is monolithic in the sense that it is all encompassing and answers everything. And if it doesn't, it wasn't worth answering in the first place. So just pay attention here. And the thing of it is, we're doing that. We have that proclivity in us all the time. Anytime we get caught into saying, I am this, yes, it's valuable to do in a kind of linguistic or dialogue shorthand. But if you leave it at that, if you determine the sum total of your social experiences by these, you're cutting into the one vast, capacity of humanity to express itself, but two, the also capacity for our own psychological flexibility. We're stilting ourselves and stunting our capacity for dealing with other things, which is, by the way, question two from the poll. The purpose of human life is to be happy. beyond, of course, obviously the TV show. I love that two people did select, of course, pass the bong. That's fantastic. Do we even use the term bong anymore? I mean, really?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm old.
Same.
Yeah. But so of course,
two people do,
and that was awesome. Obviously this was biased. I mean, I don't think I've ever asked a question in the poll that wasn't pretty clear where it was coming from, which is part of the point. I'm actually poking fun at polls themselves, in the way that it can construct these things.
No.
Yeah, miraculously, polls by Fox News universally support Trump as president. Shocking. I know. It's truly, truly mind-blowing.
Did you hear the one that came out today in that vein?
Ooh, which one?
They asked Trump voters who they feel tells the truth to them.
Right. Oh, I did see that.
Yeah. So I'll start from the bottom and read up for the largest groups.
Yeah.
42% said religious leaders tell them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
56 said conservative media figures, the people on Fox News and so forth. 63% said their friends and family, but 71% said Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah. This is one of those utterly stupid polls. I mean, what is actually polling is not who you trust more. It's polling, are you showcasing your allegiance to this idea, to your tribal calling? I mean, it was so ridiculous. I read that, I'm like, you've got to be, this is absurd.
And yet they rarely put the actual phrasing of the questions that they used. They're telling right. you these were the results, but who knows what they asked? It could have yeah. been the most leading question imaginable. You know, right. don't you think the following is true?
You know? Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's one of the things, I mean, polling science, which there is, and it's actually quite fascinating. But the, you know, everybody, the pollsters are always in search of the like perfect wording. You know, it's like, how do we, because depending on the wording, you will get different results, you know? And so even for instance, depending on like, you know, people made a big old deal out of, you know, how, you know, almost like with every indictment, Trump's popularity increased. And really, again, it kind of depends on what you ask. Because again, the way that they asked originally really wasn't polling, do you care about the ethics, which is what people took it to mean. It was actually polling, do you align with the party and its spokesperson, was really what it was actually asking. And there were some other pollsters that did a different one to show where that wasn't in that was the case, in fact, where, you know, the number of people that were in support of him actually dropped in line with some of the indictments. So
I feel like we read the same articles in the Atlantic every week.
It was from the Atlantic that was covering this. Yeah. Yep.
I know. I saw Excellent. That today.
Yeah. It's yeah. Still one of the few. Then, I mean, yeah. Then New York Times, heck, Tom Nichols writes for the Atlantic. I will read every single thing he writes. So yeah. In fact, another one, if anybody's interested, would be Rob Henderson. He has a Substack. And I have a couple, I think I have one or two articles in the resources linked here as well. But I'll be quoting from him later on as well. But Excellent. Just a great, great, great thinker. Even if you don't agree with him, which is one of my favorites, is people I don't agree with, but make me think anyway, because I have to be challenged by how well they articulated their points.
I had the most I love David fun. Fromm. Yeah. Grad so, school. Man, the most fun part of grad school was yelling about Foucault.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's yeah. great.
Right. Yes. So, so part of this then is going like, okay, so, in not getting stuck in these stories around, you know, like for instance, back to the poll a bit, happiness, you know, and I basically made up the idea right there in that longer, thank you, Kara, for reading it all, you know, definition around it, because, you know, it is in many ways a, you know, so I will describe emotions essentially as the combination of a feeling and a story that exists within a particular context. That's really what we have. So when we get caught up in our emotions, rather than being able to slow down enough to go, the kind of just all like thinking about our bodily sensations and within a particular context, when we get caught up in the emotion stuff, we've already bought into the story that has come along for the ride. We've already bought into, oh, this is how we're supposed to be thinking at this time. So part of the, you know, process of freedom and flexibility isn't being able to slow down, you know, about that. Which, hey, again, why are we doing therapy? This thing's kind of a big old plug for the secular therapy project. And so, which also then gets us into, you know, the notion of trauma, which was it. Fascinating looking at the answers that people gave. You know, you had pretty much an even split between the kind of more serious answers that were provided around it being an inevitable part of human experience, you know, about it being as well perhaps a narrative process to help explain one's felt experience about varying levels of distress. You know, essentially that's the definition of complex PTSD, is that they're basically offering it as a narrative process to explain complications that are felt to be, you know, existing within some people's lives. Whether or not it's a legitimate diagnosis is a whole other thing. Have resources on that that is neither here nor there, because this discussion, this presentation is not about that. A lot of good questions to ask about how this all works. But, and then lastly, also a third is a label for that kind of, it is not in the DSM. They have tried multiple times. They can't meet the evidentiary threshold for doing it because, yeah. Not going to get off on that tangent. It is in the ICD 11, largely in even the people who...
And what is that, David?
That's the international... I'm trying to remember what the whole thing stands for.
So what organization controls that?
Europe.
Yeah. So it's a WHO?
I don't think so, but I will plead my ignorance about that right now. So, what they validated was not the fact that there's evidence for it. They validated the fact that many clinicians were asking for it because they felt that it was helpful in, their practices. Not that there was actually evidence for it.
This is complex PTSD is what you're
talking
about?
Complex PTSD, yeah.
And how does that differ from regular PTSD?
It depends on who you ask. Some people will describe it as, regular PTSD symptoms, but happen to work within, you know, lots of other diagnoses, which frankly makes no sense. Judith Herman, who originally came up with it, she tried a few other concepts first before, you know, coming and calling it complex PTSD. She thought that it applied only to victims who suffered prolonged, repeated trauma, such as in concentration camps, prisons, coerced prostitution, chronic childhood abuse. It's where she thought that PTSD, or simple PTSD, as she referred to it, was only for victims of briefer forms of trauma, such as war, because we all know war is very brief, automobile accidents, natural disasters, because of course natural disasters are very brief as well, time limited child abuse, how you can figure out what the time limit on that is, who knows, she never bothered explaining it, horrific injuries, one-time rapes, and so on, because we all know rape only happens once and then you move on, right? There's there's a couple of really good books that go through a lot of the issues with it, several articles that have been coming out more recently that have been going into some of the issues with some of these newer toxic trauma ideas. Well worth reading. Not for the purpose, let me be very clear, not for the purpose of dismissing how you necessarily will view and the experiences, as awful as they undoubtedly have been, that you're going through. So there's a bit of a problem sometimes in these discussions where there's a category error being made, and which is where the ICD went with, and that is the attempt to explain or give a structure around personal experience in order to help other people understand what's going on. And the more kind of codified diagnostic strategy. So, you know, this is where do not go to and get your psychology from TikTok, for instance. because there are new so-called diagnoses happening all the time there. And yeah, don't get anything from TikTok. That's a really good piece of advice. Yes, everyone who disagrees with me is a narcissist. Everybody's got a narcissistic personality disorder. No, they don't.
Also, don't get your advice about paranormal events like astrology and psychics and whatever, because it is unbelievable the number of people promoting that kind of stuff.
Yes, it's what was it? The guy was a Geller, Yuri Geller recently, where he showed he shared an image around these supposed aliens, and he was called out because it was a scene from X-Files.
But did you see his rebuttal to that?
Yeah, that it didn't matter. He's like, well, even if it was an image from X-Files, they
copied the real thing.
Thing.
That's like, correct, because he saw the real thing, because he saw the aliens at one point in his young career.
It's which, frankly, and really, who else when reading that did you? So, Rod, did you catch the the religious version of that?
Like, no.
So it's a similar argument around C.S. Lewis originally peddled it, or he took it from others, I believe, but where, you know, the idea that all societies, all civilizations have a baseline ethic. And even if they don't know it, they are in fact getting it from the more basic ethic of Jesus and God, having put that stamp on our hearts, kind of thing. Like,
it couldn't be the other way around.
Right. A virgin birth and all that kind of stuff that happened before Jesus were retroactively put there in our hearts because they were in our hearts because of whatever. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah. Anyway. But really, I mean, so anytime you're looking at, you know, new diagnosis, especially on social media, it's like there are very, very specific criteria for finding an actual new diagnosis. And that's where this conversation gets split, because we can have, again, labels can be very powerful and be very helpful, but they can also be extremely limiting. And it depends on how we're using them and in what context we're doing it. You know, if I'm discussing the attempt at objective science here, there are particular criteria that we want to use in that realm of discussion. For looking at the realm of discussion around personal experience, okay, like, we can have a little bit more fun with language and have some and explore this a bit, because we're going to take the time to go, oh, this is what it means for you in the context of your own experience. Great. It's then up to the, you know, conversation and the people involved to be able to go, okay, wait, now I'm, you know, switching, which is often what we don't do, and switching to this other, you know, area of discussion, so that we can then, you know, use words in a different, you know, capacity. So there's all this going on, but diagnoses require like a set of behaviors that do not fit established diagnostic criteria. Like, they have to be outside of what's already there. Then that criteria has to not respond to established interventions. Then there are studies that have to be done in order to establish, one, a lack of overlap between the behaviors that are occurring with that don't overlap with some of the, you know, other already existing diagnoses, and that there's consistency. So you have to have a cohort. You have to, you know, find people that are actually doing this. And unfortunately, right now, most of the time, the kind of instability of relationships, the emotional volatility, and so on, that often ends up being looked at with some of these ideas, fall well within borderline personality disorder. I mean, it's just, there's just a ton of overlap there. So is it worth studying? Absolutely. We need to figure, you know, out more of what's going on. But be very careful about whether or not you're falling into a new label and going, and it must mean this, instead of taking it as, this could be really helpful for helping me understand things. And part of that then leads into, so let's see here. One, looking at, we can talk about the fourth question around superheroes later, but
that'll be for the hangout.
So, but part of here is that, you know, how fundamentalism then creates this trap for what I refer to as kind of like a, basically a trauma trap. And that one, and this is true of mass movement. So a lot of this is going to be taken from Eric Hoffer's, you know, the book, 1 second. Do you have that, Kara?
Yes, I have it. It is The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements.
Thank you greatly.
No problem.
Yeah, highly recommend. Just continues to stand the test of time here. But is that mass movements, and in particular, like cults or other things or other movements that you know, gather and kind of overwhelm the self for the purposes of getting you involved in activities that sometimes you wouldn't necessarily do if you were, say, alone and had time to reflect, is that it feeds on discontent. I mean, how many times were most of us who were brought up in a, you know, some faith or another, where you're told, like, go and have conversations with people as soon as they've been hurting, if they've lost somebody, or they're, you know, religious camps are filled with what? Fireside declarations of how their life is terrible. And they're looking for what? A means of escape and answers. I mean, they're practically writing it right in front of us. And the same thing happens with even political movements as well, for that matter, of which there are many fundamentalist aspects with some of them. You know, this idea that, well, populism these days of all its various kinds is all based on finding the thing that you're upset about, giving you the means of escaping it, and saying that the only way that that salvation of some form is going to exist is going to be within this group, that of which then is, you know, centered on this very fundamental human need to belong.
I would slightly change one of the things you just said. The first thing, I think, to find out like what you're afraid of, and like they tell you what to be afraid of, right? That's right. The thing. If you watch certain news channels, they're talking endlessly about this one problem, which is huge in their opinion on the show, but it really isn't the problem. But then you become to think it's the biggest problem in the world, and the reason you have to vote that way.
Right. So I would put that as like 1.2, simply because, or 1A, depending on how you want to, you know, just, you know, categorize these, because the problems that people center on are problems because why? They are exhibitions of the discontent in some area of their life that they're feeling. The problems we latch on to precisely because it's like, right, I knew I was feeling this way and I didn't like it. So what is it? Oh, it's that thing.
It's a demon.
Right.
It's always a demon.
Immigrants. It's the other, whatever that may be. It's that sense of existential angst, you know, that you feel disconnected from yourself, which frankly, who doesn't at some point? Who hasn't? I mean, we're not talking dissociation here. We're talking about just this baseline feel of going, I don't fit. I don't belong. I don't see where, you know, where I might be able to find, and, you know, a sense of being seen. And when you combine that, particularly these days, with the breakdown of all sorts of social institutions that, for good and ill, gave a lot of structure, you know, it's not really a stretch to see why so many of these things are coming up and why people are looking for it. So, you know, as he notes in his book, you know, it's like in the marketplace of ideologies, the dogma that is most effective at harvesting emotional discontent often prevails. The danger of mass movements lies in their ability to manipulate these frustrations. Hence Rob's point of, here are the problems, even if they aren't, but at least it gives you something to focus on. This in turn deepens their commitment, keeping them in a state of perpetual discontent and thus devotion to the movement that promises to liberate them. So the formula goes something like this. Mass movements that are good at what they do make previously content individuals frustrated, further frustrate their adherents while pretending to advance the movement. Hence so much of, you know, when we get into certain forms of activism that don't seem to actually lead anywhere, they're just basically varying forms of how pissed off and how often can we do it? Because that's not the point. The point isn't success. The point is to belong to this kind of perpetual grievance. So of course, any movement that actually advances the interests of its frustrated supporters will make them less frustrated. Why then do I need to belong to you? Why should I give you my money if you're no longer, you know, bringing me out of a hellscape? You know, it's, I mean, literally you have, you know, we're right in the middle of, or right at the beginning of silly politics season here, in which tens, hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be funneled from, you know, people make a big deal out of, big donors. But the reality is that that's still only a piece of what all, you know, everybody is giving. And these small donations, these micro donations that I think Obama was one of the first ones to really, make a big deal out of it. Trump also used it quite a lot and still is, but various others have gotten onto this. But these micro donations to the tune of millions upon millions that are being funneled from this kind of collective society into these very narrow, and then of course then disperse, but again the cone doesn't go wide back again. It's far more narrower than when it came from.
I believe the last time Trump got indicted, well, not the last time because it's been too soon to do the math, but the time before, the third time Trump got, it's still hard to believe that former president indicted four times. The third time he got indicted, I think within a week he had made $40 million in micro donations.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, in fact, I mean, shoot, many people, I mean, it's part of the, like, it's almost the monetization of even bad news is good news. I mean, it's really astonishing from perceived tragedy that it will engender, again, an emotional response. Because what are we, you know, part of this is, again, is what are we doing? So many, much of the time, if you were to actually ask individually and get into, individual conversations with a lot of people outside of even politics, like, why are you buying into this? In fact, I did a presentation with, I'm forgetting right now, but we talked about a month or two ago, where for a different podcast that was on, you know, the kind of religious experience and what's going on with it. And the host played a clip of a guy who was almost exhibiting, I mean, it was like pre-glossolalia, you know, the whole speaking tongues thing. It's just this very fast, preachy word vomit of, you know, I believe in this, and, you know, and the I am a dirty and horrible sinner that, you know, must be, you know, forgiven. And he was like, he went through this, and the guy's like maybe 20 years old. I mean, so it's like, okay, buddy. And so, you know, he's like, okay, make sense of this. And I'm like, great, thanks for putting me on the spot. But part of it is that, in part of the answer I gave was that at a certain level, the person saying it doesn't even really believe it. You know, there's I think it was Peter Boghossian who kind of popularized the notion, but you know, been many others who've explored it around belief and belief. You know, these secondary beliefs that we socially declare in order to exhibit allegiance to a particular group. But our actions do not actually support any of it. Like, when you really look at what the person then does, like, it doesn't make any, like, it's not following the logical conclusions of you and anybody who isn't a believer, even believers, like, just because you now have been forgiven doesn't mean you're not a despicable, horrible person. You just happen to know that you're going to get into the promised land. Like, okay. Like, but you're still an awful person. That's why, you know, the Catholic Church struggled for centuries with various states of, you know, ideological issues around why the flesh is so terrible. Why, you know, they struggled for so long about various notions of Christology and the nature of Jesus, because they had to stick with somehow this notion that the flesh and self is awful and despicable and horrible, but somehow Jesus was still part of it. And their solution wasn't at all actually a solution. It was just a de facto, look, it's a mystery. Both things are true. Moving on. After, of course, many, many thousands of people died about it. But, you know, it's just a fascinating piece around, like, okay, so if you really think this, though, like, if you genuinely believe that prior to salvation, at least minimum, give that way out, that you're awful, that nothing you do is worthy of praise, that nothing you do is worthy of any positivity, and yet I'm not even a betting person generally, and I would lay hard money on you go home and every single one of them, if they're a parent, they've got their kids' stick drawings up on their fridge. They're nonsense. That they sit there and listen and praise their kids for their little things, that little Johnny or little Becky is going to be the next big viral sensation because, oh my gosh, they're so amazing. You walked by the time you were 11 months old, and therefore, you know, you're going to be incredible and a new soccer player and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's just like we cannot actually live in that reality. We can't live there, not consistently. So often some, you know, and it's in fact, one of the things around social movements as well is to take a look at and go, okay, so you're saying, you know, maybe, you know, one explanation is like, well, we all like to engage in hyperbole. We all love to engage in just this bombastic language and everything's a genocide and everything's the end of the world and so on and so forth, because we want to pay, you know, get people to pay attention to us. Okay. But I don't think you actually believe it. Not in the word, like not the words themselves, because if you genuinely believe these things, then your form of activism wouldn't be posting memes. Like your form of activism wouldn't be, you know, showing up and having a good time at a rally kind of thing. Like, and it's not that these things are meaningless. That is not the point. Any more than the person peddling the salvation message within various religions doesn't hold some meaning. It's just that it doesn't hold the meaning that the words themselves seemingly convey. And we need to be conscious of that, because we catch ourselves, how often, to bring it into the personal, how often have any of us gone into judgments around, I will never X, I am Y, I am a horrible this, I did this, therefore it's, you know, my day is ruined. In a micro way, it's fun. It's the same trap. We're just doing it to ourselves. I mean, granted, we're kind of doing it to ourselves when it comes to movements as well. But anyway, you know, but that's what we're doing. And so by questioning these things, by hesitating a bit to go, you know what? Words are great. Language is fun. You know, is needed. Try not. But it's also a bit of a trap. You know, the if we're focused so much on what I don't have, on the discontent, on the feelings of being off, then we're at the mercy of forces in our own psychology, in our own just basic biological ways of looking at the world, that are going to make it very difficult to see outside of. You know, it's why CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is lauded as such an important thing. Because essentially, so part of it is I kind of look at CBT. It's not even really a therapeutic intervention. It's more of like a therapeutic. It's a logic class masquerading as a therapeutic intervention, because really what it boils down to is recognizing the biases and heuristics that we are all prone to, and learning the ways of questioning those things and causing and resulting in healthy doubt about the things, these universal statements, for instance, these us versus them statements, you know, the adversarial stuff that often happens, the malignant comparisons that we will do. I mean, that's really what CBT is. It's just this, the application of logic within, you know, the therapy paradigm. And so as a tool, set of tools, it's fantastic. But that's why it's so powerful, or can be, because it's helping us. It's kind of like science itself. I mean, if we were, you know, to merely look at how our brains function, science is not, that's why science is hard, you know, because it's based on constant questioning. It's based on the idea that we are wrong. Well, that's not what our psychology wants us to think. Like, you know,
I always thought the concept of hard science versus soft science was based on a misplaced phallic metaphor, but you know, that's just me.
You know, of all the explanations of it, I'm totally gonna run with that one.
I've never heard that, but I'll have to remember it.
It kind of makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, as noted in the comments, you gotta get your science hard.
None of the squishy stuff about feelings squishy, and people.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. But it's difficult. I mean, it's one of the things, a lot of issues with Ayn Rand, but you know, one of the things that she noted, I believe it was in her book, maybe Virtue of Selfishness, but I forget, New Revolution, I forget. Anyway, she made the point quite often. And that was, is that reason is difficult. Reason takes effort. Reason requires an almost, now her ontology of humanity was not quite accurate, to put it lightly, but her notions of, you know, it's like, you know, to act, you know, she looked at often that many influences in society are undermining reason's capacity to, you know, perfectly, you know, send us up into her version of the, you know, Uberman. I'm being a little unfair, admittedly, but a little bit. So, you know, it's just like, you know, the John Galt character there is, you know, is really this like super rational, you know, person. And that's what we should all strive for. It's not possible. But there's an element to it where the striving for thoughtful, reflective, critical, not to say anti-emotional, one you can't be anyway, but I would, you know, reframe it as a kind of acknowledgement that our baseline proclivity is not to find truth. It is to find basically the right story that gets us through the day. And to find truth takes extra effort. That's why it's so hard. That's why we have to study. You know, there's something, if I remember right, there's some kind of the history of how that word came about, has to do with hard work. But last few minutes here, I'm looking at time, is all of this, you know, taking a look at how do you pursue that and build flexibility? And I've already touched on a couple of these things, but is to actively, you know, and as consistently as possible, is to engage with the idea that our stories, including our labels, really our entire conscious experience, is basically guesswork. We are, you know, in to varying degrees educated, because again, we're all ignorant about varying things all the time, about how our interactive world works and our place in it and within it. It's like we're basically trying to figure out, like, if I do this, will that happen? Yes, it did. Awesome sauce. Like, now I'm gonna agree with it. You know, this is great. This is why habits form, because it's kind of shorthand for getting us the answers. Like, so, you know, go after and look at these things with a kind of reflective critical mind. Two, pursue relationships of any kind. So very broad uses of the term relationship here. With people of contrary opinions, based on, and there is in fact, there's a article in the resources here on the notion of starmanning, which I've brought up before in a different presentation, but it's from Angel Eduardo. I think he's one of the leaders behind the FAIR organization. But basically it's based on seeing people as charitably as possible from a position of human compassion and looking at literally everybody who you encounter, no matter how vehemently you disagree with, doesn't mean you roll over and, you know, allow awful things to happen to you. That is not it at all. But to be able to engage in such capacity to go, you know what, this person's trying to figure out like what all this means. And they're trying to figure out their own form of how to get by within their own little context and with their own little social circle, which is again, why, I mean, so these three points, and I'll get to the third one here in a second, they build on one another. Because if you start with the process of acknowledging that our stories, no matter how true they may feel, are always to some varying degree inaccurate, then it behooves us to engage in a plethora of pinatas. Anyway, one of those things where the more presentations I give, the more I realize that my brain often acts as if it's ADHD. Anyway, but the idea there of, you know, it behooves us to engage with even more ideas. Because even if we don't agree, the challenging of in the best form it might take. In fact, somebody in the comments, you know, mentioning the Satanic Temple, you know, it's one of the fantastic organizations out there because.
And we are going to have Lucian Greaves shortly, by the way.
Fantastic.
Next
week. Oh my gosh, that's fantastic.
It's next week. Fabulous.
I may have to make some time for that. But the whole notion there is that they're using the structures of religious mythology in order to play around with it, in order to shift people's relationship to it, in order to give greater flexibility to question these things. And they're like, I don't know if they're still on Twitter or not, but when they used to be, and I followed them, it was great because they, I refuse to call it X. But at least initially. People were like, you believe in these things. And he's like, no, I really don't. That's your assumption based on your religious mythology. I'm just simply noting about basically kind of libertarian notion of individualism and personalized ethics and so on and so forth. So it was just like, it's really a lot of fun with that. But when you engage with more people, then it allows you to then see, great, they too, just like me, are to varying degrees wrong or inaccurate. And so by doing so, we then can build the third piece here is build social experiences and community that are beyond all power to all everything that's going on with RFR and all the online communities, but doing so not only online. I am not some, you know, anti-tech fuddy-duddy here. This is not, saying that. It is about the difference between online communities and face-to-face ones are about how we engage differently. And it's not just about authenticity. So Hoffer notes how mass movements can be seen as a kind of community. Here's where they differ though. They require only belief and identity. Sound familiar? How do we join our online communities? Rather than reciprocal obligations and accountability. How accountable can we really be online? In fact, that's actually one of the common criticisms. It's why volunteering to plug away for volunteering for RFR here. That's why volunteering is so important. If you are going to engage in these online communities, get involved, become 20% cooler. Thank you, Helen. And in order to
22.5.
get close enough or closer to what it is to be that face-to-face quality that we get. Because when you have to engage with people at the nitty-gritty of, you know, how do we actually put these things to practice? It gets difficult. All of our ideas sound great when we're ranting by meme or Substack, but they become very problematic when we actually try to implement them in real life. You know, I swear Vivek Ramaswamy is like a walking billboard for this. The man has a whole ton of ridiculous ideas, none of which will actually work in real life. But we do it in, you know, that, you know, any number of other things as well. In a lot of the movements we get into, you know, we paddle these ideas and we're like, how does this actually work in line exactly? Oh, it's complicated. Oh, right. You mean there are a lot of ramifications of this that, you know, merely saying I believe in X are, you know, make this a little bit more difficult to implement? Right. Good. It should be. We're more complicated than one thing. Good. It's actually how we've actually been able to survive our own innate absurdity as human species, is the fact that we're more than just one thing. And not to fall into that trap again, that frankly, so many of us have already gotten out of by leaving religion and not falling into it, whether or not it's a social movement, whether or not it's an online community, whether or not it's your own personal stories of not falling into looking at yourself through one lens. Get out there, engage, have some fun. Yeah.
I like it.
And with that.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on. And don't forget to come to the excursion.
Yeah. Hey, good plug. Yes, yeah. There's an excursion. Although, yeah. How many spaces do we have left?
I think we have like one space left. So get it now. We'll talk more about that at the end. But yeah, come to the excursion. Yeah,
and that's not just an advertising, come on, you know, company. Oh, we only have one left order now. No, we looked before this and we have
it really is space. Only one left.
We really have one spot left. So while everyone scrambles to go get that spot, shall I leave everyone with this list of resources you have given us? Do you want me to put those in the chat?
Yes, by all means. Yeah.
All right. Let me do that. I'm going to put those in. And also tell us, where can people find you if they want more good stuff other than, you know, here?
Yeah. So you can find me. My main website is lifeweavings.com. I've recently redid it to focus on religious trauma, or as I'm kind of moving into trauma within a religious context. It's very much tons of resources around. It's a way to contact me. It's a way to engage either in therapy, if you happen to be in Washington or South Dakota, or more skill-based kind of coaching, if you're more interested in that, literally anywhere. My podcast, all the episodes, if you want to just really narrow in, can be found at humanitiesvalues.com, but also literally anywhere you happen to listen to them. I swear I'm going to make more episodes at some point.
It's okay. As long as you keep making RFRX episodes.
yes. You've taken over my podcast. I just do RFRXs instead. You can also find me on Facebook.
Collect volunteers.
So it's, yes. Yeah. And then if you're really interested, I have an Instagram also, Life Weavings Instagram, where I mostly post my photography.
Awesome. And all those links are in the chat, so feel free to check those out, y'all. All right, well, I think we have time for a few questions. You feel like answering some questions?
Sounds good.
All right, so Rob, you want to go with the first one?
Okay, sure. The one with all the acronyms in it. All right. I'm seeing a therapist for interpersonal trauma, CPTSD, and PTSD. Is it important to see someone who knows specifically about religious trauma, and why?
This is actually what my dissertation is about. Just had to revamp a little bit, actually. You don't have to. So the reality is almost nobody out there has any training in it. So if you are going to avoid any and all therapists simply because they don't have a particular training in religious trauma, please don't. That's really not going to do you very well. And it's going to cut off a lot of otherwise really good therapy. So that being said, be very careful as well, though. I mean, ask a few questions around, because you can interview the therapist. I mean, if they're offering, and they should be offering some form of, initial consultation, ask them a few questions about what their opinion on, religion is, whether or not they've ever heard of the term religious trauma or trauma within a religious context. I think I'm the only one using that phrase. So yeah, don't look for that either. But, ask about it, what it is, how they're going to respond to that will at least help you inform you as to whether or not they're going to be helpful, to that. That being said, a lot of, if they have a specialty in trauma work, PTSD, many of those things overlap depending on the experiences that you went through. So there really isn't a whole lot of intervention strategies, frankly, that work for PTSD, for that matter, that will also then work for trauma that exists within that context as well. There's not a whole lot of uniqueness, in one sense. So I'm trying to be careful in my wording here. You can absolutely take a look at, people who are outside of it. Just ask a few questions, look at their site, look and see whether or not they've been published anywhere, whether or not they've given interviews, whether or not they've, published anything. It's one reason why I have so many blog entries and, show up to these things. The number of, clients who, go, yeah, I was listening to your presentation through, R4X or whatever. And like, yes, I don't even need to have a consult. I'm just going to, chat with you. Or undoubtedly others who see it and go, oh, hell no, I'm not going to talk to that, nut job. So, by all means, take a look.
Let me add a little bit to that, David. Whenever someone calls and I need to refer them to the Secular Therapy Project, I always make the point, ever since the pandemic started, as you must know, it's very hard to get a therapist. Many are full, and it's harder than it used to be. So even though we have a lot of people in the Secular Therapy Project, they might be so busy that they can't give you an appointment. So what I suggest as a backup is to go to, I'm going to put the link in the chat, the secularththerapy.org/therapist page. So when you get to the Secular Therapy Project, there's a choice: register as a client or register as a therapist. Of course, most people register as a client. If you click the other one, register as a therapist, you'll see what the first step that a therapist we're going to vet has to agree to. So you can use what's printed there, printed out in a hard copy or PDF, and use that when you're shopping around, because that's the first criteria. They have to agree to that before we're going to talk to them.
Yep. Great point. Thank you, Rob. That was, absolutely.
Rob knows all the hacks.
I mean, really? Yeah.
Okay. I'm super excited about this question. I'm going to ask you this one. Y'all all know which one it's going to be. Those of you who are looking at the outline, what's your best book recommendation on our best understanding of the human self?
So I would go with, one second here. So one, not my best, but a really good, introduction to psych that just published a few months ago. So it's like the most recent in a lot of ways, research on everything. It's like a, basically it's an intro to psych book, which I'm currently going through. It's by Paul Bloom. It's called Psych. And it's fantastic. You know, most of the things, you know, largely, you know, read, but his way of putting them in, describing them is just fantastic. It's just great for anybody, even if you've been studying psych for a while. As far as, you know, kind of human self, I would go with Being You by Anil Seth, A-N-I-L, and then S-E-T-H. There's a few others that are related, but that one in particular, it's one of the most recent. Read it slowly. Not calling anybody stupid. It's just, it's complicated. And there are a lot of ideas in it that are a bit contrary to kind of socially received wisdom. So really good to explore. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. I feel like we have maybe time for one more question, Rob, if you want to pick one.
Well, I'd like to ask the Trump question, but I think I'll wait till we stop the recording for that one. So let's go to, can you explain, because I missed this myself, can you explain limerence and its relation to trauma? I don't remember hearing that word. What was that about?
I think that was in Annihilation. Yeah.
Okay.
Is it the shimmer?
Yeah, so.
I got nothing.
I'm terrible. Because I know I've used limerence before.
Limerence. I'm Googling.
Can somebody give me more context to that?
So maybe the answer, David, is to answer to the question, can you explain limerence and its relation to trauma, is no, I can't right now. That's all.
We'll go to another one. Yeah, which is terrible because I know I've used the word before and I'm like, oh my God, this is terrible.
So having Googled it, Google let me know that I misspelled it, and then went on to say it describes the experience of having an uncontrollable desire for someone, an obsession that consumes the limerent person's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, usually involves two people.
New word on me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. It's what people usually mean when they say love. Yeah. So what's interesting with some of the, yes, thank you, Glenda, for the NRE, New Relationship Energy, within the poly community, which is where I encountered NRE. Fantastic. Limerence, it's interesting around, yeah, I think there's some overlap. This is off the cuff here. So take everything I'm about to say with, again, huge grains of salt. Is that I'm in it now, full disclosure. Thank you. You know what? Beautiful. I actually love to hear that. Limerence is fantastic. I mean, it really is. Like NRE, any version of the phrase that you're gonna like, the feeling behind it can be emotionally intoxicating. That's why we don't try to get rid of it. It's probably why it still is around evolutionarily, even though, you know, behaviorally it can be really destructive, but it's just so damn good. And it helps us overcome a sense of self. It helps us with a kind of, you know, those who have engaged in some kind of psychedelic can account to a kind of similarity with that collapse of the self, that limerence tends to engender. And we love it. Like, it's great. Here's the issue, though, is it's not particularly tied to anything inherently good. It's kind of like our love affair with sugar. I mean, we need it. We have it because, one, it's a great energy source. We didn't have much of it when we were all evolving as a species, until we encountered high fructose corn syrup and everybody, you know, became obese. But, you know, it's like we don't have the systems in place very easily to deal with the overwhelming nature of that, you know, our, for that capacity for us, that propensity. So by all means, You know, it can show up in a lot of different ways. If you have, so one thing to keep aware of, if you have a person or a group who is actively keeping things vague, if they are, you know, actively going, hey, I don't really need to answer these questions, or can't we just live in the moment? You know, if we immediately launch into, you know, the soulmate language and, you know, so on, you know, again, it's not an automatic, like, oh my God, this is terrible. But you know, pause a moment, duck your head in cold water, you know, actively engage in perhaps a few things that are a little distressing, so that you can, you know, you get out of that kind of system one mentality and slow down a bit to start asking a few extra questions. It's all the more reason why it's good to engage in real communities of varying opinions, because, and then you can go to them and go, what do you see here? Doesn't mean you have to agree with anything anybody else is saying, but the mere act of dealing with that is going to help you reflect, and not inevitably so, because again, we love our biases, but it at least is a way of kind of a self-corrective, amongst many other tools that you can do. So, yeah.
Good to know. And we learned a new term. I love these educational episodes.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.